Hello and welcome back to our class on Physical Chemistry of Polymers Part 2. This is the sixth lesson unit entitled Rubber Elasticity. In our last lesson unit, we have taken a detailed look onto the mechanical spectra of polymer samples in the amorphous state, meaning polymers in the melt state at temperatures above the glass transition temperature slash or on timescales longer than the timescale tau zero, and samples in the glassy state at variable combinations below these two. We have seen that upon activation of main chain dynamics, as just said, either at high enough temperatures and slash or on timescales longer than the shortest relaxation time tau zero, the sample first displays characteristics of a viscoelastic solid, as phenomenologically described by the Kelvin-Voigt model, for which we have received a microscopic conceptual explanation on the basis of the Rouse and Zim modeling framework in view of the sequential activation of coil internal relaxation modes. Once we consider times longer than the longest relaxation time, which is the Rouse or the Zim time in these two modeling frameworks, all dynamics of the coil are active, and so from that point on, the macroscopic appearance of the sample is expected to be that of a viscoelastic liquid, as phenomenologically captured by the Maxwell model. This kind of rheological characteristics is indeed observed for polymer melt samples composed of comparably short chains, whereas by contrast, samples composed of long chains show a further regime before terminal flow sets in. This regime is an intermediate frequency-independent plateau of the storage modulus that extends over greater and greater domains on the time or frequency axis at larger and larger molar mass of the chains, respectively chain lengths, before terminal flow sets in. The ordinate value, meaning the magnitude of the modulus, however, is independent of the chain molar mass or chain length. This is both visible in figure 88 of the script. Here we see three data sets represented by a blue curve, a green curve, and a black or dark gray curve. The blue curve shows behavior as we would expect it on the basis of our initial discussion, in a sense that at very high frequencies, there is a glassy regime with a frequency-independent modulus that displays high values. At lower frequencies, there is the leather-like regime of coil internal relaxation modes that, as we have seen in our last lesson unit, displays frequency-dependent scaling of the modulus with a power law exponent of 1/2 or 0.5. And eventually, on frequencies corresponding to times longer than the inverse Rouse or Zim time, terminal relaxation with scaling according to the Maxwell model sets in. In the green curve, by contrast, we see the onset of an intermediate plateau that is quite extended in the black curve dataset. The reason for this plateau is that for molar masses higher than a certain critical molar mass, which corresponds to chain lengths longer than a certain critical length, the chains become able to form mutual entanglements. We have clarified to us in an illustrative example already in our last lesson unit that just like Mensa spaghetti, polymer chains have a certain finite stiffness, and so if they are very short, this stiffness prevents them from forming entanglements. Just as very stiff Mikado sticks cannot entangle with each other also. If the chain length is longer than a certain minimal one, however, the stiffness is overcome, so to speak, and the chains can be conceived as flexible coils. That, if the concentration is high enough, which it definitely is in a melt state that has a concentration of 100%, so to speak, volume fraction 1, the coils overlap and penetrate through each other and form mechanical entanglements. This minimal length can also be expressed by a minimal weight or minimal molar weight, meaning molar mass, which is denoted as ME in figure 88. If the chain length exceeds the critical one, which can also be expressed in terms that if the chain molar mass exceeds the critical one, then the timescale which is needed for eventual chain relaxation for macroscopic displacements of the coils against each other by distances longer than their own size is shifted to longer timescales, because that then requires disentanglement of the chains, which has to occur by a special mechanism named reptation mechanism, which our next lesson unit will be devoted to. On timescales shorter than that time, which by the way is named reptation time, as we will discuss in much more detail in our next lesson unit, the chains are not yet capable of disentangling from each other, but by contrast, that time domain, which is the one covered by the rubber elastic plateau, the chain entanglements act as if there were permanent connections between the chains, permanent cross-linking junctions. Permanent in a sense that the system cannot get rid of them on times shorter than the reptation time. And this time shifts to longer and longer and longer times, the longer and longer, meaning the heavier and heavier the chains are. That means the extent of the rubbery elastic plateau regime on the frequency or time axis gets larger when the chain length, or respectively the chain molar mass, gets higher. The target of our present lesson unit is to quantitatively assess the impact of the entanglement on the mechanical properties in the domain of the viscoelastic spectrum where the rubber elastic plateau is found. As in that domain, the entanglements are permanent as if they were chemical crosslinks, our strategy in this lesson unit will be to treat them such. Meaning, in the following discussion, we will make a detour from polymer melts to cross-linked polymer networks, also referred to as rubbers. This clarifies to us the title of this lesson unit. As the sample is elastic in that state, the concept that we will consider in this unit is the concept of rubber elasticity. We will do so from two viewpoint angles. The first one is a classical continuum's thermodynamics approach, and the second one is a statistical thermodynamic approach. Let's start with the first. Whenever we do classical continuum thermodynamics, the quantity that we look at is the free energy. The free energy is a marriage of the first and second law of thermodynamics, so to speak, combining the central quantities internal energy and entropy, in a sense that all processes in the whole universe happen spontaneously and voluntarily, so to speak, in a prescribed direction of interest if that quantity is negative throughout the process. This is the case when energy is negative and/or entropy is positive. As denoted in the elementary equation, F is equal to U minus TS, as written down in equation 5.56. If we are interested in the deformation of a material, in this case a rubber, a quantity of interest is the force that is necessary to achieve a certain extent of deformation. This force generally calculates as the length derivative of the free energy, and therefore as the length derivative of internal energy minus T times the length derivative of entropy, as written down in equation 5.57. For entropy, we know the general thermodynamic identity that entropy is the negative derivative of free energy to temperature. So in equation 5.58, we replace the derivative ds by dl by the derivative minus d to dl of df to dt. And as entropy and free energy are state functions, they obey the criterion of symmetry of second derivatives, also referred to as Schwarz theorem, Satz von Schwarz in German. So we can switch the order of differentiation here and turn it to minus d to dt of df to dl. And df to dl, as we've just seen, is the force denoted by a non-capital F. So in the end, we have minus df by dt standing here, whereby the F is written in non-capital letters, denoting the force necessary for deformation. Reinserting that into equation 5.57 generates equation 5.59. The force equals the length derivative of internal energy plus temperature times the temperature derivative of the force. That equation is plotted to you in figure 89. Here we see a plot not of force versus temperature, but of stress versus temperature, which is simply force normalized to area. According to equation 5.59, we would expect a straight line with slope df by dt and intercept du by dl. In the curve, we see a data set that is obtained such that a material specimen is deformed at different temperatures, and we always measure the stress that arises in the sample specimen upon stretching it by a certain extent dl. What we see here, surprisingly, is not one linear data set, but two linear data sets with opposite slopes centered around a characteristic temperature, which is the glass transition temperature. At temperatures higher than the glass transition temperature, we have a positive slope, meaning a positive partial differential df by dt in equation 5.59, denoting to us that deformation is harder at higher temperature. This is the typical hallmark of an entropy elastic material. From part one of this lecture series, we know two prime examples of entropy elastic matter, which are gases and polymers. In both, deformation doesn't have notable energetic effects, because in a gas, there is generally weak interactions between the particle, because if there were strong interactions, the matter wouldn't be a gas, but a condensed phase, such as a liquid or a solid. And so deformation, which in a gas means compression, does not cause so much of an energy penalty. Nevertheless, we feel a strong raise of the pressure when we reduce the volume. What is the cause? It is a reduction of entropy that we create when reducing the volume. Reduction of the volume takes away liberty for the gas molecules to arrange themselves in space, and this causes an entropy-based penalty. In a polymer chain, deformation, which there means stretching, is most easily accommodated microscopically by local rotation around single bonds in the monomer units, such to transform local cis or gauche conformations into trans conformations. Such a bond rotation, as we also know from the part one of this lecture series, and also from yet even earlier, from elementary organic chemistry introductory courses, does practically not cost any energy. It costs energies in the range of a few kBT at room temperature, which is easily affordable. So in contrast to other potential local deformation means, like the stretching of the chemical bonds themselves, or the distortion of the bonding angles. Local torsion, meaning rotation of the bonds, is very easily possible energetically, and so this is the local mechanism by which external deformation of the chain is locally accommodated. That means, upon stretching of the chain on local levels, we turn local cis or gauche conformations into trans conformations, and thereby make the coil more ordered. The most ordered form we can think about this is when all bonds are in a trans state. This macroscopic state of a fully elongated chain is microscopically realizable only by one sequence of local bond conformations, namely the all-trans one. So there is only one microstate that realizes this macrostate. Whereas by contrast, the macroscopic state of a randomly coiled coil is realized by a myriad of different microstates, namely various kinds of mixes of cis and trans conformations along the chain. According to elementary statistical thermodynamics, this can be translated via the Boltzmann formula into an expression for entropy, denoting to us that the entropy of a stretched chain is low, whereas the entropy of an unstretched chain is high. We can also express this shorter by saying a stretched rod-like coil is more tidy than an unstretched, randomly coiled coil, and therefore it has a lower entropy than the other one. In both these examples, the gas and the polymer, deformation causes a reduction of entropy, and that causes a resistive force against which we have to work when attempting to deform. We feel this as pressure when we try to compress a gas, and we feel this as elasticity when we try to stretch a polymer. In figure 89, at temperatures above the glass transition temperature, we encounter this very situation. Polymer chain dynamics is activated as we are above the glass transition temperature, and so stretching of the polymer is accommodated by local bond rotation of local cis or gauche conformations into wider trans conformations, which, as we just said, reduces the chain entropy, and that, as we also have just said, causes a resistive force that we here feel in terms of a stress that arises in the sample, and that's the quantity we measure here. And apparently, according to figure 89, the stress arise in the sample is higher at higher temperature, meaning it gets harder to deform the material at higher temperature, because, according to elementary thermodynamics, a drop of entropy is always more severe at high temperatures than it is at low temperatures. Because in any thermodynamic equation, entropy is always accompanied by its best friend, T. We always have T delta S, never delta S alone. And so a reduction of this term is more severe at high temperatures than it is at low temperatures. The contrast situation is experienced at temperatures below the glass transition temperature. Here, we have a negative slope in figure 89, meaning deformation is harder at lower temperatures, or vice versa, deformation is easier at higher temperatures, if they are not yet higher than TG. This is a typical footprint of an energy elastic material. In energy elastic materials, the classical stereotype example of this is a piece of a metal wire, macroscopic deformation is locally accommodated such that we increase the interatomic distance in the material. The interatomic distance in a solid is a consequence of the interplay of attractive and repulsive interactions as captured within the Lennard-Jones potential energy function that has a minimum at a certain equilibrium distance. As long as the atoms are at that distance to each other, energy is minimal. If we now stretch on the material, we artificially increase the interatomic distance, meaning we pull the molecules out of this comfort zone potential energy well. And this comes along with an increase of internal energy, as reflected by the Lennard-Jones potential. And that causes a resistive force. This is what we have to work against when attempting to stretch the material. So here, not entropy, but energy is the cause for the resistance against deformation, which is why we refer to that as energy elasticity, in contrast to entropy elasticity in the other case. In the energy elasticity case, increase of temperature will help us, because increase of temperature will increase the thermal energy in the system, which is always helpful if we want to overcome energetic barriers or want to work against resistive energies. To speak in the picture of the Lennard-Jones potential energy function, if the atoms are wiggling around their equilibrium positions more heavily to greater and shorter distances, then bringing them to those distances, meaning shifting the equilibrium distance, is better activated and therefore easier possible. For polymer samples, we encounter that state for temperatures below the glass transition temperature, because in that state, chain dynamics is inactive, the sample has a glassy appearance of an amorphous structure with no dynamics, and so their deformation can only be accommodated by moving the atoms themselves away from each other. Local unfolding of coiled chain conformations to unfolded conformations is not possible there. So here we have to work against the interatomic attractive forces and are in the energy elastic domain therefore. In our following discussion, we focus on the high temperature scenario, meaning samples with activated main chain dynamics that display entropy elasticity upon stretching of the chains. So we're considering the right branch of the dataset in figure 89. When we extrapolate this dataset to the left, this is shown by the dashed line, indeed the intercept of that hypothetic extrapolated dataset that hypothetically spans the full temperature range is indeed small. This again denotes to us that the energetic contribution, which is reflected by that intercept, dU by dL in equation 5.59, is small for these kinds of samples. Because, as we have just said, the way of how macroscopic chain stretching is microscopically accommodated on local scales is by bond rotation, by bond torsion, and that doesn't cost much energy of activation, as represented by the negligible intercept of the extrapolated dataset in figure 89. There is one further insight that we can gain here, namely that in that state, the material heats up upon stretching. This is thermodynamically outlined to you in equation 5.60 of the script, in which an expression for the partial derivative dT by dL is derived, which turns out to be minus 1 over heat capacity times temperature times length derivative of entropy. In the entropy elastic state, as we have just discussed, this length derivative of entropy is negative, and together with the overall negative sign on the most right-hand side of equation 5.60, the left side, the differential temperature to length, turns out to be positive, meaning temperature increases upon increase of the length. You can actually check this in a little home experiment by taking a rubbery band, stretching it, and feeling that it indeed gets warm. The most sensitive part of your body that can feel this are your lips. So if you kiss, so to speak, a rubbery band and then stretch it, your lips will feel that it indeed gets warm. All right, after that little macroscopic, phenomenological, chemical, thermodynamic discussion, let's now focus on the microscale. Let's have a look to the statistical thermodynamics of rubber elasticity. The basis of that consideration is a result from part one of this lecture series that we have qualitatively discussed already a minute ago, which is laid down in equation 5.61, the entropy of an ideal polymer chain, as derived from a statistical treatment of the number of microstates that realize an unstretched, unperturbed, and stretched macrostates. We have discussed this in the third lesson of part one of this lecture series on the basis of a mathematical consideration of the random walk statistics for the shape of an ideal polymer coil and the resulting distribution of chain end-to-end distances, which shows us what conformations of chains reflected by what kinds of end-to-end distances are realized by many microstates and therefore likely, and which microscopic conformations corresponding to certain other end-to-end distances are realized by only a few microstates and therefore unlikely. The outcome of this discussion was that a chain end-to-end distance of 0 is the most likely one, whereas all greater chain end-to-end distances are less likely. The least likely was the one where the chain is in a fully expanded conformation realized by an all-trans sequence of local microconformations. Plugging in that result into the elementary Boltzmann formula has eventually delivered to us equation 5.61, the entropy of an ideal chain. It is composed of a zero-point entropy, that's the entropy corresponding to the state with a chain end-to-end distance of zero, and an R-dependent term that is subtracted from that, that shows us that the actual entropy reduces from the zero-point value the higher the end-to-end distance R, here expressed as R square, actually is. This term is a ratio of the variable r square in the numerator and its mean square value in the denominator, which is here denoted as r square in spiked parentheses with an index 0. This denotes to us the equilibrium mean square end-to-end distance of an ideal chain, which, as we also know from part 1 of this lecture series, can be expressed as n times l square, which is the notation in the denominator in the rightmost hand side of equation 5.61. This equation expresses the entropy of a single ideal polymer chain. We now assume the chain segments between two cross-linking points in a chemically cross-linked rubber to be describable by the same formalism. Meaning, now we adopt this formula to all these network strands between two cross-linking points in a cross-linked rubbery network. Upon stretching of the whole material specimen by a certain extent, also these chains are stretched. And now we make a central assumption, that is, that we assume that the local extent of stretching of the network strands is by the same ratio as the macroscopic overall deformation of the whole sample specimen. This is shown to you in figure 90 of the script. We consider a rubbery body, here represented as a cube, with side lengths Lx, Ly, and Lz, denoted Lx0, Ly0, and Lz0 in the unperturbed, unstretched state. And within that, we have network strands that naturally have an end-to-end vector of R0 with three components Rx0, Ry0, and Rz0. And upon stretching, by certain stretching ratios denoted lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z, the whole specimen size changes in these three geometrical dimensions, and the same change also adopts to the microscopic change of the network strand chain end-to-end vector, which components rx0, ry0, and rz0 are multiplied with the same scalar stretching ratios lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z. This central assumption of our derivation is referred to as the affine assumption. We assume that the network deformation is the same on macro and on micro scales. The network deforms in an affine fashion. This kind of theoretical modeling is therefore also referred to as the affine network model. Based upon this premise, we can quantify the change of the entropy that occurs for each single network chain that we assume to be ideal here, as expressed in equation 5.62. Delta S corresponds to the entropy of the stretched chain minus the entropy in its unstretched state, and this is calculated simply by adopting equation 5.61 to the two states and taking the terms together by applying the microscopic identity outlined in figure 90, which means connecting the end-to-end vector components rx, ry, and rz to the ones in the unstretched state, rx0, ry0, and rz0, by application of the stretching factors lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z. From this equation, we easily obtain the entropy change for the entire network. We simply have to sum over all its n network strands, as outlined in equation 5.63. We can simplify this equation by considering the case of an isotropic sample, where the average chain end-to-end distances are equal in all spatial directions. There is no preferential direction for the end-to-end vectors of the chains in this case. We mathematize this criterion in equation 5.64, in which we introduce a different variable now, note that. The mean square end-to-end distance with the index u denotes us the mean square end-to-end distance of the network chains in their undeformed state. Multiplication of that equation with n, the number of network chains, rearranges it to the form 5.65, and inserting that back into equation 5.63 gives us equation 5.66, which boils down the change of the entropy of the rubbery network specimen to the extent of the stretching ratios lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z. Note that there is a factor of the two mean square distances that we have considered along our discussion, the mean square with the index u over the mean square with the index 0, meaning the mean square end-to-end distance of the network strand chains in their undeformed state over the mean square end-to-end distance of the network strand chains under the assumption that they are ideal. In many cases, this both is the same, so this factor is very often left out because it's 1. It is not necessarily 1, however. For example, if we consider cases where the making of the network, the chemical preparation, the synthesis of the network, occurs at different extent of chain stretching than the probing of the network. For example, if we make a network in the dry state and then probe it in a swollen state, or vice versa. But if we ignore such situations for the moment, we can actually leave out this factor in equation 5.66. And indeed, in many textbooks, you won't find it because they leave it out. Apart from this little mathematical detail, what we conceptually see by looking upon equation 5.66 is that the entropy reduction upon stretching a rubber is more severe if we stretch to a greater extent, because that manifests itself in higher stretching strain ratios, lambda x, lambda y, and lambda z in the equation, which makes delta s larger. I mean, larger in the sense that it gets more negative. And delta s is also higher when we have a greater number of chains that are stretched, when the n in that equation is higher. How is that realized? How can we have a greater n in a given network specimen? N counts the number of network strands, meaning the number of chain segments between two cross-linking points. If we have a given fixed number of chains in the sample in total, meaning mass of polymer material per volume, then the only way to, for example, increase n is to increase the cross-linking density, to introduce more cross-linking junctions, because then we have more cross-links in the system, and therefore also more chain segments between two cross-linking points, which are then, of course, shorter. So what we see here already is the onset of another structure property relation. The number of network strands n has to do with structure. It has to do with the cross-linking density. The higher the cross-linking density is, the more cross-links we have in the system, the higher is n. And, footnote, the shorter are the network strand chain segments between two such cross-linking junctions then. This structural parameter, according to equation 5.66, translates into a fundamental thermodynamic quantity, delta S. And we can guess already that it will just take us another minute to translate this into macroscopic material parameters. Namely, spoiler here, the elastic modulus. How do we get to that? We first insert the result of equation 5.66 back into equation 5.56, delta F equals delta U minus T delta S. As we regard the network strand segments to be ideal, there is no change of internal energy upon stretching. Because in ideal chains, the monomer segments don't have interactions, neither with one another nor with their surrounding environment. And so energy is careless about their mutual distancing, and so doesn't care about stretching. The delta U term is therefore zero, which only leaves us the minus T delta S term, which then directly gives delta F, as outlined in equation 5.67. This is a very general equation. Let's specify it a little by looking upon typical actual experimental situations. The first one we look upon is the case of isochoric uniaxial strain, meaning stretching of the material specimen along one of the spatial directions under assumption of constant volume, meaning the elongation of the material in the direction of stretching has to be accommodated by a thinning of the material cross-section in the other directions, such that the volume stays constant, meaning delta V shall be zero. This trivially causes that the product of the strain ratios, lambda X, lambda Y, lambda Z, has to be 1. And if we consider uniaxial strain, we only need to consider one of them, namely the one in the one direction we stretch into. So we do no longer need to differentiate between lambda X, lambda Y, and lambda Z, but can just consider the case of stretching in, let's say, X direction, and then just name lambda X lambda. According to the isochoric conditions that the former lambda X, lambda Y, and lambda Z have to give a product of 1, the two other strain ratios, lambda Y and lambda Z, are forced to be 1 over the square root of the then remaining 1 lambda that was formerly lambda X. Taking this into account, in equation 5.67 turns it into equation 5.68. This equation denotes as a free energy change, and from that, as we have seen earlier in this lesson unit already, we get to an expression for force by calculating the length derivative along the axis of deformation, as it's done in equation 5.69. From the force, we can get to a generalized, normalized expression of the stress by normalizing the force to the cross-sectional area, as it's done in equation 5.70a. And due to the isochoric condition, which we can further simplify by simple geometric arguments into equation 5.70b. In that equation, we can simplify the term in the parentheses, lambda square minus 1 over lambda, by another mathematical approximation, as outlined to you in the script, to transform it into equation 5.70c. Stress is equal to n kbt over v times 3 epsilon, whereby epsilon is the extent of uniaxial strain, as we have defined in our very first lesson unit in our very first equation of that lecture, equation 5.1. This equation has the appearance of Hooke's law that establishes a proportional connection between stress and strain, with a constant of proportionality denoted as elastic modulus. So here in equation 5.70c, we identify the factor 3 times n kbt over v as the elastic modulus, as written in equation 5.71a. We further know that for incompressible solid objects with a so-called Poisson ratio number of 0.5, the elastic modulus equals 3 times the shear modulus, or vice versa. Shear modulus is elastic modulus divided by 3. And if we apply that to equation 5.71a, we obtain 5.71b, which tells us that the shear modulus of a rubbery elastic network is n kbt over v. Yet again, this equation is a very elementary quantitative structure property relation. On the left-hand side, we have a fundamental material property, which is its elastic shear modulus, that we know is the constant of proportionality in Hooke's law, so this is a quantity telling us how hard it is to shear the material, which is a quantity directly relevant for mechanical engineers, whereas the right-hand side of the equation contains a microscopic structure information, the number of network strands n per volume v, meaning the network strand density or concentration in the rubber polymer network specimen. So this equation does tell us directly the greater the cross-linking density of the rubber is, the greater is the modulus, in a linear proportional fashion. What we also see from this equation is very conceptual fundamental insight, namely that each network chain, of which we have n over v in our sample specimen, stores an energy increment of kbt upon deformation. Yet again from that we see the modulus increases with temperature, which is logical, because the whole concept of that we have a modulus, meaning that we have a resistance on deformation, is entropy-based. And as we have seen, entropy is always more mad at us if we mess around with it at higher temperatures than if we do so at low temperatures. We can also conceive and therefore also write down this identity in a slightly different fashion by making us clear again that a higher number of n, a higher number of network strands, in a sample with a given mass amount of polymer per volume corresponds to shorter network strand segments between two cross-linking junctions. And so an alternative expression of equation 5.71 is the denotation of equation 5.71c, where it is expressed on a molar scale such that the elastic modulus is the grams per volume density of our sample times thermal energy, here expressed as RT, over the molar mass of the chain segments between two cross-linking junctions, denoted MX here, the molar mass of a cross-linking strand. Yet again, this quantity is a structure property relation, because it denotes the structural parameters of the network chain concentration or network chain density and the molar mass of the network strands to the modulus. Yet again, we see from this expression that a higher cross-linking degree causes shorter and therefore lighter network chains that are then more numerous, and therefore an inversely proportional higher modulus. What we also see when looking upon equation 5.71b is that its form is strikingly similar to the ideal gas law, which doesn't read G is equal to nKBT over V, but P is equal to nKBT over V. This is logical because, as we have seen already, the whole concept of rubber elasticity relies on the phenomenon of entropy elasticity, and that is also encountered in gases, including ideal gases. In fact, a simple statistical thermodynamic approach, just as the one we've just followed that has led us to equation 5.71b, can be used to derive the ideal gas law. It's a very simple estimate. We estimate the probability, denoted omega, for a gas molecule in a container to sit in a certain subvolume V of a greater total V0. This probability is simply V over V0. And from that, we easily get to the probability of an ensemble of n gas molecules to all do that, meaning for n gas molecules to all sit in that subvolume of the greater total. This probability is omega with an index n is equal to V over V0 to the exponent n. From that number of microstates, we get to the macroscopic variable entropy by the Boltzmann formula, S is Kb times ln omega, which here then delivers us Kb times n times ln V over V0. In thermodynamics, the state variable pressure generally calculates as the negative derivative of Gibbs free energy to volume, and Gibbs free energy in turn is enthalpy minus temperature times entropy, so pressure can be conceived as the negative derivative dH to dV plus T times dS to dV. As we are considering an ideal gas, we have no interactions, meaning the energy or alternatively enthalpy term is careless about change of their mutual distances, so this term is zero in the equation, which means pressure equals temperature times the volume derivative of entropy. So we just take the latter equation for entropy that we have gained from the Boltzmann formula and differentiate it for volume and multiply that with temperature to get P is equal to nKBT over V, the ideal gas law, which we here have derived from a statistical viewpoint on very similar grounds as the formula for the elastic modulus that we have derived in this lesson unit, based on the picture that we count the number of microconformations that realize a certain macrostate. In the ideal gas example, this was the number of microconformations that realized the state that such and such many particles all sit together in one subvolume inside of a greater total. Whereas in the ideal network chain scenario, this was the number of possible microconformations that realized the macrostates of a stretched versus an unstretched chain. Then we have plugged this into the Boltzmann formula to get an expression for the entropy, and then we have plugged this into a definition formula for free energy to get an expression for that, and then differentiation of that has led us to a force expression that was then further transformed into a stress and then into a modulus expression in case of the polymer chains, whereas it was further transformed into a pressure equation in the case of the ideal gas. Both in the end delivered strikingly similar results. Footnote here, what we also see from that similarity is that the modulus, as it's seemingly so related to pressure, of course, also has the unit of a pressure, pascals. We're on the roll at the moment and eager to consider a further example, the case of an isotropic shear experiment. Footnote, this is a very typical situation, because as we have seen in one of our preceding lesson units, that indeed the shear deformation scenario is the most predominant one in the classical experimental situation of macroscopic oscillatory shear rheology. In this case, we have no deformation in the z direction, meaning the stretching ratio lambda z is 1, whereas the two others can then be simply defined to be lambda x is lambda, and lambda y is then forced to be 1 over lambda. This turns our free energy expression into the form denoted in equation 5.72, which we can then further transform into a force and then stress expression as denoted in equation 5.73. Again, this is a form strikingly similar to Hooke's law, in this case for a shear deformation scenario. And we identify the constant of proportionality between stress and the extent of shear deformation to be the shear modulus, G, as expressed in equation 5.74a. That we can also express in a different representation in a molar variant form as denoted in equation 5.74b. As expected, these two equations are identical to the equations 5.71b and equation 5.71c found in our other experimental scenario earlier. Up to this point, our discussion was on sample specimen with permanent crosslinks. As we have seen at the very beginning of this lesson unit, and that has then actually led us to this path, another form of hindering polymer chains from relaxing is mutual mechanical entanglement. The difference of the two forms are sketched to you again in figure 91. On timescales not long enough to get rid of these mutual entanglements, these in fact act as if there were permanent chemical crosslinks and create a rubbery elastic plateau in the time of frequency-dependent representation of the elastic modulus, as shown to you again in figure 91b of the script. A polymer network, in fact, has both contributions. It has permanent chemical crosslinks, and it also has chain entanglements that then are also permanent because they are trapped and can never get loose. So in fact, the modulus can be split up into contributions from actual chemical crosslinks and from trapped mechanical entanglements. This is outlined to you in equation 5.75. As we have just said in the sentence earlier and at the very beginning of this lesson unit, even completely uncrosslinked polymer systems that are just or only composed of mutually entangled chains show a rubbery elastic plateau on intermediate timescales in the mechanical spectra due to the entanglement contribution. Meaning then, the modulus G in equation 5.75 is only constituted by the entanglement part, whereas the crosslink part is zero, as written in equation 5.76. A striking experimental finding in this context is that for many polymer melts, the height of the plateau is similar. It's in the range of a megapascal, 10 to the 6 pascals, which is because the strand length between two entanglement points is indeed similar for many polymer chains, as many of them have comparable flexibilities. As many of them are essentially based on carbon-carbon or carbon-oxygen chain backbones, where the local rotatability around the monomer-monomer bonds are more or less similar, as also expressed by comparable values of the characteristic ratio of many standard polymers that can form nice polymer melts, by the way, and so a more or less universal value of around a megapascal for the height of the intermediate rubber elastic plateau in the mechanical spectra results. Again, note that the prerequisite for this domain to occur at all is that the chains are longer, or in other words, heavier, than a certain minimal chain length, or minimal molar mass, needed to actually form entanglements. If the chains are shorter than that, they don't show a rubbery elastic plateau. If they are longer than that, they show a rubbery elastic plateau with a universal G value of around a megapascal. And the extent of this plateau on the time of frequency axis is more and more extensive the greater the chain molar mass is, as visualized in figure 91b. What does not change upon increase of the overall chain molar mass or chain length, however, is the entanglement strand length or entanglement strand molar mass, because this is the length of a segment between two entanglement points, and that has to do with the chain stiffness. But this does not change if the chain as a whole gets longer. If the chain as a whole gets longer, what increases is the number of entanglement strands out of which it is composed, but the length of each single entanglement strand is unchanged. And that's the quantity entering equation 5.74b or 5.71c, determining the height of the modulus, which, as just said, turns out to be more or less universal with a value of around a megapascal for many samples, independent of their total overall molar mass, as also visible in figure 91b, where the extent of the rubbery elastic plateau changes, but not its height. A little closing further note to this discussion, all what we have discussed so far is based on the entropy formula of an ideal chain. That means all of the above applies to ideal chains in both the unstretched and the stretched state. We will indeed notice deviations from these statistics if the stretching gets too severe, because then the chain end-to-end distance statistics can no longer be assessed on basis of the ideal chain random walk model. Here we have to apply different statistics, for example, the so-called inverse Langevin model. Footnote here, this is again an analogy to gases where at high pressures, meaning high levels of compression, deviations from ideality are noticed because then interactions come into play. And so we must treat the equation of state and transform it from the ideal gas law to the real gas law, for example, in the framework of the van der Waals equation. On top of this deviation from ideality at greater extents of stretching, there is of course always a natural deviation from ideality as the chains are not ideal. The chains have interactions. And these interactions can also come into play. For example, if we stretch our sample specimen severely, according to the criterion of volume conservation, the sample specimen gets thinner in the cross-sectional directions perpendicular to the direction of stretching, which means in these directions the chains come closer to each other. They may come so close that attractive interactions between them start to dominate and we form little nano or microcrystalline domains, For this to occur, certain prerequisites have to be guaranteed. For example, the chains have to be chemically able to crystallize, which demands a well-defined local main chain regularity and tacticity. If this is granted, however, the chains can indeed form crystalline domains upon coming closer, upon stretching, which then creates physical network junctions, so to speak, physical cross-linking nodes, which then make the material specimen harder, as upon the stretching, we then practically increase the cross-linking density. This phenomenon is referred to as strain-induced hardening. Once more, this is an analogy to gases, which in fact start to liquefy if we pressurize them severely. There is one further point that I want to open up here, and this is a further mode of network deformation caused by the influx of solvent as it occurs during a process of swelling. In that process, a fluid medium enters a polymer network and expands it into the three spatial directions from the interior. The driving force for that is favorable thermodynamic contact between solvent molecules and the monomer segments. If we conduct a swelling experiment with a good solvent, it is favorable to establish monomer-solvent contact, which causes unfolding of the network chains such to allow for such contact. In short, the chains want to dissolve. Unfortunately, however, they cannot, because they are cross-linked to each other. So that means the only thing that can happen is that the solvent penetrates into the network specimen and stretches the chains in it and therefore swells it. This, however, then comes along with a counteracting force due to the entropy-based elasticity of the chains. At an equilibrium state, both tendencies are at balance and the network has reached its swelling equilibrium. The point where this lies depends on where this balance lies. We are further swelling if we have a greater tendency to establish monomer-solvent contact, meaning if the solvent quality is better for the polymer, and also the less the counteracting force is, which means the lower the cross-linking density of the network is. To quantify this, a quantity that is commonly used is the degree of swelling, as denoted in equation 5.77. It's the ratio of the network specimen in swollen over unswollen state. To estimate the equilibrium degree of swelling, the best thermodynamic approach is to balance the chemical potentials of the mixing tendency and of the counteracting elastic force. The chemical potential for the mixing tendency is simply represented by the Flory-Huggins equation from part 1 of this lecture series, as written in equation 5.78, whereas the counteracting elastic tendency is represented in equation 5.79 on the basis of the entropy elasticity concept, which can be further transformed via equation 5.80 into equation 5.81. At a swelling equilibrium state, the chemical potentials due to the mixing contribution and the elastic contribution are at balance, as expressed in equation 5.83, which eventually delivers us an equation to calculate the molar concentration of network chains, for example, as denoted in equation 5.84. Again, this equation is a structure property relation. It connects the structural parameter of the concentration of network strands to the property parameter of the swelling degree. In this connection, there's a further microscopic parameter in, which is the Flory-Huggins polymer-solvent interaction parameter chi, a thermodynamic quantity that quantifies the solvent quality. In the equation, we again see the interplay of these parameters. The lower the Flory-Huggins parameter is, which thermodynamically means the better the solvent quality is, the greater is the degree of swelling at a given concentration of network chains, meaning at a given polymer network cross-linking density, and vice versa. The lower the cross-linking density, the greater is the degree of swelling at a given Flory-Huggins chi parameter. The phenomenon of swellability of polymer networks is in fact the basis of one of their most technically relevant properties, namely the ability to take up loads of solvent and immobilize it within the network structure by swelling. The most relevant liquid to do this with is water, and polymer networks that are capable of swelling in water then create a class of materials referred to as hydrogels, which are relevant in such a myriad of applications that there is no chance in mentioning them all here. It spans fields like hygiene products, chemical or biological analytics, drug delivery, tissue engineering, and many more. A very sophisticated branch of applications is to make such materials with polymer networks that have environmentally responsive polymer-solvent interactions, meaning a Flory-Huggins chi parameter that is distinctly dependent on external variables, such as, for example, temperature. Meaning that when these variables, for example, temperature, change, so does the Flory-Huggins parameter, and so does the swelling degree of a gel specimen. The principle of such stimuli-responsive swelling and deswelling is sketched to you in figure 92 of the script, which then gives the basis for stimuli-responsive materials that can again be imagined and actually conceptualized to be used in various applications, such as artificial muscles, chemomechanical actuators, or, so to speak, intelligent, smart microcapsules or carriers in the biomedical field. As an example, consider, for instance, that inflammatory tissue has a little higher temperature than healthy tissue. That's the reason why it's called inflamed. So if we now think about a polymer microgel-based capsule that carries an anti-inflammatory drug, we may create a formulation in which this drug is first shielded by encapsulation in the capsule and then released from the capsule upon triggering a swelling-deswelling transition of the capsule by the temperature difference between inflammatory tissue and healthy tissue. A related application can be thought about in view of the pH dependence. Cancer tissue is a little more acidic than healthy tissue. If we now think about a polymer microgel capsule composed of a network whose polymer has a Flory-Huggins polymer solvent interaction parameter with water that is pH dependent. This may make it possible to release a cytotactic anti-cancer drug from a microgel capsule formulation that undergoes a swelling-deswelling transition triggered by the pH difference between cancer tissue and healthy tissue. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has been a very intense one, I admit. What we have seen in it is how a statistical thermodynamic approach delivers us one of the most elementary formulas in the fields of polymer materials engineering, which is a connection of the elastic modulus of a polymer network to its cross-linking density, which is actually expressed in the equation by the number of network strand segments in the network. This delivers a basis for a whole field of industrial applications. The most prominent examples for products based on rubbers is car tires. And in those, indeed, the elasticity plays a central role for their performance. So here, materials engineers have to work on the very grounds of what we have learned today. Let me illustrate this to you in another example that may be a little more practice relevant to you than car tires. Shoe soles. These are also rubbery based, and users, meaning customers from different fields, require different sorts of performance. Whereas professional marathon runners want shoe soles to be highly bouncy, to have a good rebound in every step of the run, with the aim to gain back as much of the energy possible from the step into the next one, and not losing it by dissipation to the street, so to speak. By contrast, in the field of leisure activities, such as hiking, users, meaning customers, want a good damping of the shoe sole to make a long hike on the trails comfortable to the feet. We see diverse kinds of users have diverse kinds of demands on the material. With our knowledge that we have gained in this lesson unit, we can now tell what microscopic structure of the polymer rubbery network will deliver either performance. A good rebound is achieved by networks with a high elastic modulus, footnote not too high because then they will be brittle, which is realized by a high enough cross-linking density. By contrast, damping is realized by elements in the network that are there but do not contribute to elastic energy storage upon deformation. And such elements are defects in the network structure. For example, loose dangling chains. Chains that are connected to the network only with one extremity, whereas the other is non-connected and therefore the chain dangles around. Another such feature would be loops, meaning chain segments that do not bridge between two different network sections, but by contrast where both their extremities are connected to the same point in the network, thereby forming a dangling loop. Such connectivity defects are features that are part of the network but do not contribute to the ability of elastic energy storage. So what those do in turn is dissipation of external energy, as they are mobile to move, at least partially move. These features are like viscous elements attached or fixed to the network body. And whereas their denotation as defects at a first view sounds undesired, it is actually desired when good damping properties shall be realized in the material, as it's demanded by leisure activity users such as weekend hikers. Another very great field of application of polymer networks is in the field where they are supposed to take up solvent. And the most relevant solvent to think about is water, which is the main component of our bodies, and therefore also of liquids that may leak off it. I'm speaking about urine. And so polymer networks capable of uptaking water are the basis of superabsorbers in hygiene products such as diapers. This is actually still a very active field of industrial research. At a first view, you may think that diapers are an established product that exists for decades and that is present in mass amounts in every grocery store. Indeed, this is the case. Nevertheless, the hygiene industry is still interested in further improving the performance of diapers because this will allow them to realize the same function with less material, which saves cost. And on top of that, for all these applications, being it in diapers, being it in shoe soles, or being it in car tires, or whatsoever further form of polymer network-based functional entities, an emerging upcoming desire is to realize them with their same performance on the basis of degradable, most ideally recyclable materials, to contribute to mankind's need, urgent need, to transition our energy and materials economy into a cyclic and renewable one. So from that, you see how practically relevant all that is what we have learned today, and how that very content may perhaps form the basis onto a later job in which you will work on and in which you will get back to what we have discussed today throughout your professional work. In the context of our lecture, the discussion on rubber elasticity was actually a detour to understand the intermediate rubbery plateau in the melts of entangled chains. With that, we now almost have a complete conceptual understanding of the mechanical spectra of polymers. We have a microscopic description of the extreme short-term glassy state, which is characterized by no dynamics at all. We have a description for the short-term leather-like regime, which is characterized by coil internal relaxation modes. And now we also have a description of the rubbery plateau, which is caused by a halting, so to speak, of relaxation due to mutual entrapment by entanglements. What is still missing to us is a microscopic conceptual understanding of the last regime, the terminal flow regime. We can already phenomenologically describe it, that we do with a Maxwell model, but what we don't have yet is a microscopic conceptual model that describes us on microscopic levels how the chains move and eventually become able to displace against each other over distances longer than their own sizes, such to eventually cause free flow. For that goal, we need a conceptual microscopic picture of how chains move in a local surrounding of mutual entanglement. This framework is given by the reptation mechanism, as will be on the agenda of our next lesson unit.